Welcome to the Food Matters Live podcast, where we showcase the innovations, the big ideas, and the visionaries in the food industry. We dig deep, we look to the future and the past, and we question everything we think we know about food. I'm Anthony Zara, and this episode was recorded live at the Food Matters Live event held in Manchester in November 2024. This session was titled Keeping Up to Speed with the Science and Opportunities in Gut Health. Your host is Dr. Claire Munialo, Senior Lecturer in Food Science at Harper Adams University.
So without wasting much time, we'll start with the first speaker, who is John Walsh. John is a co-founder of BioNMe, and his talk is entitled A Brand Perspective on the Gut Health Trend, Consumer Demands and Opportunities. Join me together as we welcome John for his talk.
Hello. Very nice to meet everybody. I apologise, especially to Dave at the back. I tend to wander when I'm talking. So can everybody hear me? Okay. And first thing to point out, I don't know who knows about BioNMe very much, but I'm not Dr. Megan Rossi. So for those of you who have hard of sight, that's actually slightly important today because she's the scientist, she's the gut health doctor, she's the research fellow at King's. I was just chatting about how King's is an amazing centre of gut health expertise. There we go at the back. And I'm rather acutely aware that I'm kind of in a room at a conference full of experts on the subject. So I am incredibly unlikely to teach you anything new about gut health. Honestly, you know the facts. What I'll try and do is bring the consumer and the customer perspective on what's going on in gut health. So I'm basically going to show you how we talk about gut health to our retail buyers, the supermarkets, Tesco, Sainsbury's, etc., and how we talk to consumers about it, because that whole education piece is so important. And hopefully that will sort of show you how we think about gut health, what we think the trends on gut health are. The other thing, just to sort of explain about me. So I'm not a scientist. I'm on the commercial side. So I used to work at Procter & Gamble, Nestle, sort of the big food companies, Thai Union, John West. Just a quick check. Who remembers Sunny Delight? Does anybody remember? Yeah. So I'm 54 now. So when I was about 24, I was the launch brand manager on Sunny Delight. So BioNMe is basically my way of saying sorry about Sunny D. Yeah. So having got a laugh, I was next going to go for a bit of emotion. Food Matters Live actually holds a special place in BioNMe's heart because that's what the logo used to look like. We were chatting earlier, but so back in 2018 was when I'd worked with Megan on a dairy project before when I worked at a dairy, but she invited me to Food Matters Live in Excel. It's so nice you've come out of Excel and come north, but in 2018, and that's where she said to me she wanted to start her own food company. I told her she was mad, she had no idea how much work it would be, etc. But I had some spare time at the time, so I helped her out, and the rest is history, as we say. So it was at Food Matters Live 2018 that our baby BioNMe was born. So thank you very much, Food Matters Live. We like you a lot. So I am going to just touch on what BioNMe is all about. This would be an interesting test. How many people have heard of BioNMe? It's always, oh, wow, okay, that's, wow, I didn't need to come today. I think your strategy should be really obvious. We're not trying to have any secrets here. We're trying to build the best gut health brand we possibly can the right way, so we're B Corp certified, etc. And our purpose is to make claimably good gut health deliciously easy. If there's a couple of words to zoom in on there, we are a food brand. So I'll talk today about gut health, but food needs to taste nice. So we do really work hard on the taste side as well. But then that incredibly awkward word we've shoved in, claimably good. So Megan does design every single recipe, and we will never launch a product that can't carry the good for your gut health claim. So one way or another, and we'll say a bit more about health claims. It was interesting in the session earlier about regulations, etc., in the ASA. I'll explain how we view that. But everything we do has to carry a good for your gut health claim. That's what makes us different. So that's what we are all about. So in terms of how we talk to buyers, this is the chart that we use. And again, I'm a bit apologetic. It's going to be embarrassingly simple for people in this room. But We start off, it's normally, by the way, Megan who would chat this chart through, so it's her and I who go and meet the retailers. First of all, well, she actually corrects herself. She starts off by saying, we are what we eat, and then she changes it to, we are what we digest. And that's, you know, really important, and she explains that. Then we go on to the fact that 70% of the immune system is in the gut, and that really came about because of COVID. So we launched in November 2019. We got our first supermarket listing, Waitrose, in February 2020, which was 6 weeks before the first lockdown. So we were very lucky to be in our supermarket at the time. But obviously, people's interest in immunity went through the roof, and buyers are human beings as well. So we were talking to them about their individual gut health systems. Quite a lot of our buyers come to Megan's clinic on Harley Street, etc. So because they want to improve their own gut health as well. And then we start to talk to them about the microbiome, the 35 trillion bacteria, et cetera, et cetera. We also explain to them that's where our name came from, so the biome, bio and me, and we sort of bring them in on the journey that way. Where, in truth, though, they tend to get more interested is on the right-hand side, because whilst that's the science, and buyers do tend to be more interested than the majority of consumers, really what they're kind of interested in is what's in it for me. And each individual person will latch on to something that's personal for them, whether it's, you know, losing weight, diabetes, fewer sick days. The happier one down the bottom, the whole gut-brain axis, that really grabs people. That's intuitive. They're reading all the newspaper articles about it. It makes a lot of sense. So we hook people in through that benefit a lot as well, which is terrific. Then we remind people again, though, having done a bit of science, it is all about taste. This chap over here on the right-hand side, he's one of our favourites. He's not an actor. He's just somebody who happened to come up to one of our stands, and hopefully you'll be able to hear him now.
Bio me, such good gut health, like, fantastic. Like, I can't recommend it highly. It's so good. Try it. Woo!
There you go. He's my favourite. But it does make the point of, if we're going to do, it's like the convenient truth for us. The more good gut health we can do, we need to be in people's tummies each time we go in. And the way to do that is to taste nice. So then Megan talks through the science. And there's four points that we tend to make. And then this reflects on our product design principles. So we have a range of granolas, porridges and mueslis, so cereals. And then we have kefirs, so drinks and yogurts. And hopefully what you'll see is from these principles, again, I think everybody in this room will know, our recipe design, our product strategy then flows. So the first is plant-based diversity, then whole, not refined, more fermented food, and then restrictions on food additives. Obviously, again, hearing the conversations earlier about ultra-processed food, I'm pretty sure everybody in this room will know all about the first one. I haven't gone back to check, but I think Megan was probably the first scientist from King's who started going on about the target of having 30 different plant-based foods a week. Now, what's brilliant is all the scientists are saying the same thing Tim Spector does. You know, Hugh Fernie-Whittingstall picked up on it. He's not a scientist, obviously. But everyone is now pushing the same message. And it's great, because in a world where, you know, people are cynical about experts, to have them all saying the same thing is incredibly powerful. And we really like that. So 30 plant-based foods a week. Whole, not refined, I think, you know, again, everybody in this room, consumers, I think, a bit less. But we work very hard. The famous, like, with our almonds, we'll always have the skin on, etc. It's more expensive, but it is much better for you. Megan talks about using the right kind of oats, not quick oats, etc. So we work very hard on that. Then there's more fermented food. That's the real live fermented food, not if you're just encapsulating, because that tends just to go straight through you. So it's the kefirs, the kimchis, etc. And again, you know, live and active cultures, it's a very, very big growth area, I'm pleased to say. And then limiting food additives. I understand there was a debate yesterday about UPF. So again, that, you know, the science that's coming through, more and more research, I understand, being done at places like King's, will really push that agenda forward over the next few years. So that's, again, the four big principles we take the buyers through. And I know, by the way, people love to knock the big supermarkets, but those individual buyers in there, they really understand it, and they are trying to push this agenda forward. And actually, on some of the change that we see, you know, when you get Tesco to make a rain change or whatever, that they really are forces for good in terms of size of change. So I give them credit, whereas I know lots of other people like to knock them, but they are, a lot of them really are trying to do the right thing. So in terms of how that flows through to our product principles, on the cereal side, I mean, it's not hard to guess. We call it delicious diversity. So we try and put as many different plant-based foods into each of our products as possible. The target that Megan and Tim talk about is 30. So on average, our granolas have about 15 in. I think the highest one is 17, the lowest about 12. But therefore, you get about half of that diversity from one bowl per week. So we're not the whole answer, but we are a very, very good step towards it. And if you do it every day, you know, even better, etc. Whether it's vegetables, nuts, seeds, whole grains, legumes, fruit, etc., that's what we put in on the whole grains as well. And through those recipes that Megan designs, that's what enables us to have the EFSA Good For Your Gut on all of our products. On the kefirs, again, you won't be surprised. It's all about the live and active cultures. There's a couple of ways of looking at it. From a consumer point of view, I think they just tend to zoom in on the biggest number. So we have about 100 billion in each pot. The nearest competitor is about a quarter of that. So, I'm not sure the science would quite say you can therefore say we're four times better, but we do have more in. I think where Megan would go to is the number of different culture strains. So we have 18 versus the next best at 14. But even more, Megan would zoom in on which of those strains have actually got science proof behind them, of which we have two. So, and then loads of other benefits as well. But from a gut health point of view, really, really zooming in on the live and active cultures. That's what we focus on a lot. Last couple of slides. One just thought, it came up, I was mentioning gentlemen's presentation earlier and about the ASA, who've got a tough job regulating on health claims, etc. You know, there are a lot of regulations, there are a lot of claims, and we know that most companies are trying to do things the right way, but regulations do change. And just being honest, I suspect there are companies who are playing fast and loose with it. So I'll use the example. When we started, you used to be able to make the prebiotic claim. You could do it on chicory root fibre. I'm sure, again, everyone in this room knows Kellogg's lost a case with the ASA 18 months, 2 years ago, something like that. So you can no longer make the prebiotic claim. And I just think, having watched other categories work, so for example, the probiotics word you can't use on food anymore, I just think we all need to try really hard to get it right, because otherwise we'll spoil it for each other. And consumers are, you know, skeptical. If they see something go wrong on one brand, they'll often translate it across. So to have that trust and honesty is really important. So I talk to lots of other founders about it. We help other brands try and get it right. There are lots of, you know, most people who get it wrong have made just by mistake as opposed to deliberate. One or two other cases, I'm not quite so sure. But, you know, my plea today would be, please try and get it right, because it's important. And then my last slide, say thank you, but also not the next speaker, but the one after, is going to be talking about menopause. And that was another big trend coming through. So a little bit of breaking news for you. So quarter one of next year, we should be launching a specific menopause granola with a certain supermarket. So hopefully it's being made very soon. So as long as that trial goes okay, we'll be doing that. But I'll leave her to talk about it, because she knows more about it than me. Thank you very much.
Fantastic. Would you like to join me to thank John so much? And so that we can be able to have at least time for every questions, please do write anything you want to ask John. We will do it at the end. We have time for the question and answer session. We're going to transition next to Dr. Holly Neal, who is the scientific officer at Yakult. She's going to be talking about feeding your microbes, the role of diet and probiotics on gut health. Over to you, Holly.
Thanks so much. It's so, so lovely to be with you all here today. My name's Holly, and I'm sure lots of you are familiar with Yakult, the little fermented milk drink with live bacteria in it. So I actually sit within Yakult Science for Health, so we sit slightly separately from the commercial side of the company, and we're very much an education hub for primarily healthcare professionals. I have a PhD in nutrition, and I did a postdoc in nutrition as well before transitioning to industry. So John said he wasn't going to touch on science,
whereas
I'm going to go deep into the science. Our world is obsessed with big. We're told to dream big, go big, the bigger the better. But I'm here to ask the question, isn't it small that matters most? Those small little everyday moments have the power to transform. As a nutritionist, I know that it's those small, sustainable changes that we can get patients or clients to make that is where the real power is. Or maybe you've had a really stressful day at work, you've been really anxious about a big presentation, you've came home, you've collapsed on the sofa and someone offers you a cup of tea. Those small moments really can make all the difference. And that's what I'm going to talk about today, the power of small, and specifically the power of billions of tiny microorganisms living in and on each and every one of us. So what am I talking about? Obviously at Yakult, our favourite topic, the gut microbiota. So first of all, we're just going to get us all kind of on the same page in terms of thinking about the role of our gut microbiome. Then we're going to do a bit more of a spotlight in terms of diet and touch a bit on plant points that John already hinted at, as well as doing a bit of a deep dive into probiotics before wrapping up with some take-home messages. Now, if I was to ask people in the room or even customers out there, what do you think of whenever you think about gut health or why is your gut important? You're probably immediately going to think about digestion, but I want to challenge you to think beyond the belly. So yes, our gut is involved in the fermentation of non-digestible dietary fibres to produce really important short-chain fatty acids. It's also involved in the synthesis of some vitamins as well as the absorption of minerals. But actually, that's not even beginning to touch the tip of the iceberg whenever it comes to all the different organs and systems that our gut is involved with. And this is really a snapshot of some of those. So we hear, you may have heard about this gut-brain axis. So the idea that our gut is linked to our mental health and vice versa. We also see a link with immunity that John touched on. We know that around 70 to 80% of our immune cells sit in the gut. And our gut essentially trains our immune system to know what's a threat and what's safe. We also see links with metabolism and with hormones, even during menopause, that Clemens is going to touch on. And then we also see links with the gut-skin axis, which is a bit of a more emerging topic, this idea that our gut health can impact our skin health and our skin function and vice versa. And actually, at the minute, we're working with King's College London on a scoping review looking at the gut-skin axis. So like I said, very much just at the tip of the iceberg whenever it comes to all the various different organs and systems that our gut microbiota is involved with, but I encourage you to think beyond the belly. Now, obviously, depending on how healthy your gut microbiota is will determine how well or how effectively it carries out all those various different functions. And this is whenever we come with, I guess, a bit of bad news that we simply can't define what a healthy gut microbiota is. And that's because it is entirely unique. So if you look to the person to the left or to the person to the right, your gut microbiota is going to be very different to theirs. And we even see that within identical twins, only around 40% is the same. So it really is as unique as your fingerprint. However, what we can agree on is that there's three characteristics that are key, and that's diversity, resilience, and stability. So very simply, we like to use a rainforest analogy. So if you think of a rainforest that is an absolutely flourishing ecosystem, there's plants, there's flowers, trees, wildlife, birds, insects. It is so, so diverse, and that's essentially what you want your gut microbiota to be like as well. What this means is if you're hit with a challenge, so say, for example, you take a dose of antibiotics, which is going to wipe out, yes, all the bad, but also wipe out the good. So if you have that really diverse ecosystem within your gut microbiota, you're going to bounce back to that stable state so much quicker. Now I live in London, and I'm sure lots of you here today have travelled up from London as well. And in my garden, I have like a half-dead tree. So if you think of that half-dead tree in my garden, if you chop that down, you're going to notice that so much more than in this rainforest analogy where you have this real flourishing ecosystem. So whenever it comes to our gut microbiota, the key principle there is focusing on diversity. Lots of different factors affect our gut microbiota. There's obviously ones that we have control over. There's ones that are non-modifiable. So thinking about medication, like I mentioned, antibiotics, but also laxatives, protein pump inhibitors. Then as we age, we naturally see that the diversity of our gut microbiota declines, and especially for females, as we enter menopause, we see a real sharp decrease in the diversity of our gut microbiota, and it becomes more similar to the male gut microbiota. Genetics as well play a role. Obviously, being at Food Matters Live, one of the main things we've focused on is diet, but I think it's really important not to forget about those lifestyle factors. So thinking about making sure that we're getting good quality sleep, we're minimising stress, getting enough physical activity. I know those three are often easier said than done, but all of those play a really crucial role whenever it comes to impacting our gut microbiota. And then for what I'm going to focus on for the rest of the presentation, obviously the role of diet has a huge impact on our gut microbiota. And I think it's actually such a really exciting opportunity where we can really take control of our diet and actually have a massive knock-on effect there. Historically, whenever it came to gut health and diet, I think we kind of often thought about exclusion and kind of what can we cut out? Any gut health issues, it was what do we need to strip away? You know, gluten obviously being an obvious one. Whereas nowadays we're much more focused on this idea of inclusion, not exclusion. So thinking what can you add to your diet? Thinking about adding more fibre, more fruit and vegetable, more whole grains. It's really trying to make your diet as diverse as possible because diversity breeds diversity. You've maybe heard that phrase, eat the rainbow, and sometimes it can seem like a bit of a cheesy statement or something that you'd say to kids, but actually there can hold a lot of truth in that. Whereas you're eating the rainbow, you're getting this real great diversity in your diet, you're getting a variety of different vitamins, minerals, polyphenols, all of that is so crucial for our gut microbiota. This will probably come as no great surprise, but whenever we look at the observational data, whenever we look at individuals who follow a diet that is high in fruits, vegetables, whole grains, legumes, such as the profile on the left, so something that would kind of replicate a Mediterranean-style diet that we've heard about yesterday, they're going to have a much greater gut microbiota diversity compared to the profile on the right. That would be more similar to kind of a traditional Western diet that's higher in sugar, saturated fat, ultra-processed foods. Their diversity is going to be much less compared to this profile on the left of someone following more of that Mediterranean-style diet. Now, John hinted and touched quite a bit about this whole idea of 30 plant points. So, yeah, I'm sure that you're all familiar with that and have seen that maybe mentioned in the media or newspapers or even TV. And this is a study where it was really picked up from the American Gut Microbiome Study. So what they found here was they looked at the gut microbiome of over 10,000 individuals, and they found that those who consumed 30 or more plants per week had a much greater gut microbiome diversity, and they had a much greater number of short-chain fatty acid fermenters compared to people who had 10 or less plants per week. Now, this can feel really overwhelming, and especially working at Yakult, whenever we're speaking to healthcare professionals or GPs, this idea of 30 can feel really overwhelming, and often whenever they're speaking to patients, you know, even just the idea of 5 fruit and veg a day, that number 5 can feel overwhelming to people, and now you're suggesting 30, like, what? How is that even going to be possible? But I just want to highlight that it extends far beyond simply fruits and vegetables. It includes whole grains, so thinking about your whole grain rice, pasta, yes, fruits and vegetables, absolutely, as well as legumes, thinking about chickpeas, beans, lentils, as well as nuts and seeds, and even herbs and spices can really help build up that number of plant points that we're getting throughout the week and increasing our diversity within the diet. These are some top tips that we like to share. And again, you'll kind of hopefully get the sense from this that it's really, like I said, all about those small, sustainable changes, because that's where there's so much power to make a big difference. One of the things we like to encourage is this idea of making simple swaps. So say, for example, you always like to snack on peanuts. Why not pick up a bag of mixed nuts, or a recipe calls for red peppers? Why not switch it up with red, green and yellow peppers? Or maybe you're making a bolognese. Why not take out some of the meat, replace it maybe with some lentils, beans? It's all about those simple swaps that actually can make a massive difference. I obviously couldn't touch on diet and its role on gut without mentioning fermented foods. They're absolutely such a hot topic at the minute, and I know, John, you'd absolutely agree there. I think of my grandma 15, 20 years ago, you would have went to her house and she was serving you sauerkraut and all these foods that seemed very strange at the time, so she was absolutely ahead of the time, whereas nowadays you simply walk down the supermarket and you're kind of inundated with all these different types of fermented foods. So yes, we're thinking about kefir, kombucha, sauerkraut, tempeh, there's lots and lots of different options there on the supermarket shelves. And whilst it's a new trend, it's actually something that us as humans have been consuming for thousands of years. I would say that most of the research now is done in kefir, and that's where we have the strongest evidence, but we're still waiting kind of for research almost to catch up on the public interest that surrounds fermented foods at the minute. So we absolutely see that it can modulate the gut microbiota, and there is an enhanced nutritive value. People joke this is their least favourite of the presentation, where we put this big red box between two of their favourite food groups, bread and wine. And it's just really to highlight that some of these foods that we consider fermented foods don't necessarily contain live microbes. So I don't know if there's any bakers in the audience. I'm not a baker by any stretch of the imagination. I would burn toast. But if you think of the example of a sourdough where we've added yeast, you know, we've got these live microbes in it, but then obviously we put it in the oven and then that heat's going to destroy those live microbes. So just something to be aware of whenever you're hearing about fermented foods, that not necessarily all of them are going to contain those live microbes.
Prebiotics, I'm not going to spend too long on this, but prebiotics, they would be a type of non-digestible fibre, and these essentially are the food for the bacteria within your gut. So it would be things such as inulin, fructooligosaccharide, galactooligosaccharide, and chicory as well. But for the purpose of today's presentation, I'm going to do a bit more of a deep dive into probiotics. So the research shows that probiotics absolutely can change the gut function and composition within the gut. And we have a really strict definition of what probiotics are. So they're live microorganisms that, when administered in adequate amounts, confer a health benefit on the host. And if you were to lift up a probiotic on the market, whether it was a milk, whether it was a powder, a capsule, you'll see it labelled according to genus, species and strain. In the case of Yakult, Shroda, that's named after our founder, Dr. Shroda, who first identified this strain of bacteria over 85 years ago, and actually Yakult was the first probiotic on the market. However, with other strains, whenever you look at the packaging, it could be a selection of letters, it could be a selection of numbers, but it's really important that you look at the strain because there can be strain-specific effects. So whilst probiotics is kind of this umbrella term, there'll be some effects that you'll kind of see widespread, but there'll be some effects that are very specific to strains. There's so much growing body of evidence and research coming out whenever it comes to probiotics and linking it to various different health outcomes and health symptoms. And this is really just a small snapshot. Obviously, in the interest of time, I'm just going to touch on three, but just to highlight that it's an ever-growing area of research. And we even see, obviously, links with mental health, brain function, even bone health. And I think over the next couple of years, we're just going to see this continue to grow more and more. So first up, thinking about irritable bowel syndrome, IBS, I think this is something that we're starting to hear about a lot more ago, even like 5-10 years ago, it wasn't really that commonly talked about. Around 10 to 20% of the population struggle with it, and it flares up various different gastrointestinal symptoms, such as cramps and bloating. And what we do see from observational data is if you look at the gut microbiota of individuals with IBS patients, they have a very imbalanced gut microbiota, so a state called dysbiosis, compared to healthy individuals. And there's likely lots of different reasons to play why someone struggles with IBS, but it looks as if probiotics could have a potential role to help people with their symptoms. Now, I'm not sure how familiar people in the room are with reading meta-analysis. Something interesting from this particular review that I wanted to pull out very briefly is this idea of single-strain probiotics, because it's something that we get asked quite a lot about, this idea of single-strain versus multi-strain probiotics. So obviously, single-strain, they're just being one type, and then multi-strain, they're being multiple different types of strains within a product. Whenever it comes to multi-strain probiotics, ideally, what you want to see is that there'll be the list of all the different types of strains in that product. However, what can be often on the label is just the total amount of colony-forming units, and that's the units that we would use to identify bacteria. So you may not necessarily know how much is there of each individual strain. And maybe if you've picked a probiotic because there's a particular strain in it that you know that there's health benefits, you want to know that there's sufficient amounts of that particular strain in that product, which isn't necessarily the case whenever it comes to some multi-strain probiotics. There's also the argument that you may be able to see individually each one of those strains works, but what happens when you group them all together? They could work just as well, they may even work better, or there's the potential that they compete. So in an ideal scenario, you want to see a multi-strain probiotic that lists all the different types of strains, as well as the quantity for each one, and that they've done research in the product themselves, rather than focusing on other studies, simply looking at single strains. You want to see that the research has been done in the product as a whole. However, whenever it does come to probiotic research and reviews, obviously with a review, you ideally want to compare like for like. You want the studies to be as similar as possible. However, whenever it comes to probiotic research, there's a lot of heterogeneity. And by that, I mean there can be loads of variation between the dose, the duration, the strain, the age of the population, the geographical location. There's lots of different variation there, which can sometimes be a limitation. Moving on then to think about antibiotic-associated diarrhoea. So this can be seen in up to 25 or 30% of individuals who take an antibiotic. And specifically, I want to consider C. difficile infection, because this is quite a common concern that we see, especially in hospital patients. So again, another meta-analysis. This time you'll see that each row, again, is a different study. This time, if the line falls on the left-hand side of that middle line, it shows that it favours the experiment, it favours the probiotic. And again, just jumping your eye down to that bottom red box, you'll see that overall, whenever the evidence is pulled together, that diamond falls on the left-hand side, which shows that it favours the probiotic. So in this particular meta-analysis, whenever they pulled together 31 studies, so a huge number of participants, over 8,600, and we find here that probiotics reduce the risk of C. diff-associated diarrhoea by 60%. Changing gears slightly then to think about immune function, and like I said, you want to make sure that you're looking at the strain of a particular probiotic, because there can be strain-specific effects, and this is where immunological effects, you're not necessarily going to see that across all strains. Now, upper respiratory tract infections, so essentially the common cold. I'm sure half the people in the room here are struggling with a cold at the minute, and if you aren't, you probably know someone who is. And if you're anything like my family and friends, whenever you have a bit of a cough, you're immediately going to the supermarket, you're buying oranges, you're stocking up on vitamin C, but actually you'll see that there's quite strong evidence whenever it comes to the use of probiotics. New meta-analysis here, you'll be glad to see. But this was a Cochrane review, so it was looked at 12 randomised controlled trials whenever they pulled it all together, over 3,700 participants. And they looked at assessing the effect of a probiotic on acute URTIs and primarily looking at Lactobacillus or Bifidobacterium. So these would be the two most common probiotics that's most well researched. So if you look at a paper, there's a good chance that these are the two that have been researched. What they found in this particular review, whenever they pulled together the evidence, is that probiotics prevented the occurrence of at least one episode of a URTI, and it also reduced the duration of an episode of the URTI. So next time you're someone you know has a bit of a sniffle, a bit of a common cold, you can impress them with this fun fact whenever it comes to probiotics. So just wrapping up then, like I said at the beginning, I really encourage you whenever it comes to gut health to really think beyond the belly. Whenever it comes to our gut microbiota, it is so much more than digestion. We see links with brain health, immune health, metabolism, hormones, skin. It is so, so vast. We are what we eat. Diversity absolutely breeds diversity. So you want to be thinking again about that rainforest analogy, making sure that your diet is as diverse as possible, filled with fibre, fruits, vegetable, whole grains, making sure that your diet's as diverse as possible so you get that rainforest in your gut microbiota. Focusing on inclusion, not exclusion. What can you add more to the diet rather than taking away? Live dietary microbes, such as in fermented foods, can absolutely add diversity. And we see that probiotics can have a positive effect on health, but do take care with the strain and make sure that whatever product you're picking, that there's research backed up in it. Obviously, I wanted to flag something to do with Yakult. Yakult stands for health. We create lots and lots of different resources. It's all free to download on our website, so please do check it out. I wanted to highlight three of our newest ones. So we've got the Female Gut Health Guide, which I think will hopefully overlap with a lot of what Clemens is about to speak on. But through that, we go through fertility. We talk about puberty, menopause, perimenopause, pregnancy. So if you're interested in women's health, we'd definitely recommend that. In the middle, I'm showing our gut health habit tracker. So this is a A4 tear-off pad. So it's a way that yourself or patients can help track their 30 plant points per week. So it encompasses really the five pillars of gut health. Yes, diet, but also focuses on stress management, sleep, hydration, and exercise. So again, free to download, or we're happy to post copies as well. And then lastly, our brand new resource on the gut-brain axis. Didn't touch on it really at all today, but if you're interested in that, do download that, because that gives you a really great overview of the current evidence base. And with that, just a massive thank you to all of you for being here today. A thank you to my Yakult colleagues in Europe, especially my manager at the back, Dr. Emily Prippa, who was on the panel yesterday. So yeah, thank you so much again.
Fantastic. So we'll go to the final speaker of this session, who's going to be Clems, who is a registered nutritionist and well-being specialist, Rocket Fuel Wellbeing, and she will be talking about exploring the pivotal role played by the gut microbiome in women's health in the menopause, translating the science into practical application. Over to you.
Thank you very much. Good morning, everyone. I'm delighted to be here today. So it's a long title, but we're going to look at the gut microbiome during menopause and just explore whether it might be a good place to find a therapeutic avenue for menopause symptoms and physiological changes. So I'm Clémence Cleave, Clem will do, and I'm a freelance nutritionist. And I'm particularly interested in women's health, metabolic health, and well-being in the workplace. And my company is called Rocket Fuel Wellbeing. Today we're going to talk about menopause. I've got too much content, so I do apologize. So I'm going to skip what we're going to explore, and hopefully it will become clear. But let's start a bit with looking at what is menopause and why is it important to address this topic. Okay, it's a hot topic at the moment, it's everywhere, but I really want us to really understand what it is and what it means for our society and for women in general. So menopause is this moment when we run out of eggs, okay? It is the end of the reproductive phase of a woman's life. So this is, it's one day. It's the day where you have stopped having your periods and you retrospectively define it. So when you spend 12 months without a period, then you are considered to have gone through menopause. But it doesn't happen just suddenly. It's menopause is a process. It's in making over several years. And actually, the menopause transition can last up to 10 years if some for people, and it can start late 30s, early 40s. So it's a very long time. It's a time where your hormones are all over the place. And I heard this brilliant definition of menopause. It's, menopause is puberty in reverse, okay? So think of all this, how you were when you were 15 if you're a woman, or where your sister was when they were 15, and these up and downs in moods and these changes are and phenomenal and really affect your life. So yes, you've got a decline in estrogen and progesterone during the perimenopause and through menopause, but actually it's just this erratic effect that is sending you a bit crazy, to use a technical term. And it comes with an array of symptoms, but also some fundamental physiological changes. And why does it matter? It matters because I heard somebody said, oh yes, we need to consider menopause in women because we need to look after after all the minorities. We're not a minority. We are half of the population. So yes, it's very important. It's estimated that a woman will spend a third of her life in menopause. And if you think that perimenopause starts early 40s, in your early 40s, it's about half of your life where you are feeling the effect of menopause. And 75% of a woman in the UK have changed the way they are living because of menopause. We have to make adjustments. And 50% of women in menopause said that menopause has had a negative impact on their social, professional, and sexual life. So I hope that you're now convinced that it's a crucial time in a woman's life. But it doesn't only concern women, it concerns all of us, because it's a critical challenge for our economies, for the workplace, our society. We need to talk about it, we need to understand it, and we need to provide support for women. And also, it's a time where women are looking for answers. They're seeking help. So it's an amazing opportunity for us to support women at that moment of life. I mentioned an array of symptoms. It goes from hot flushes, sleep disturbance, mood swings, anxiety, depression, brain fog, reduced libido, UTI, vaginal driveness, weight gain, you know, this middle-aged spread that so many women mention, and also gut issues. Are you all... it's exciting, huh? And these were the symptoms, but it also comes with some physiological changes. So we might not feel it. Some women are lucky, they don't experience that many symptoms. But nevertheless, there are some deep transformation, deep things that are happening in the background, no matter what. And one of them is that they increase their risk of cardiovascular diseases. So higher level of cholesterol, I talk about the middle age spread, the body fat redistribution is happening at that point, and so we get fat around our waist. our bone mineral density loss accelerate at that point of life, and so we are more prone to bone fracture and at higher risk of osteoporosis. And there is also an increase in inflammation. Now let's just zoom in. I said we would be talking about the gut. It's the topic of this session. So let's look deeper into the gut. The evidence is limited on the gut and the symptoms, probably because they are underappreciated and underreported. But what are the common symptoms is bloating, diarrhea, constipation, altered mobility, the speed at which the food is traveling through your gastrointestinal tract, and also a heightened gut sensitivity. So we know that IBS is more prevalent within women, and it gets even, this sensitivity is increases during menopause. And so 50% of women in the UK report experiencing gut health gut symptoms, and they tend to be considered to be fairly bothersome. You've got in one hand, so they're more bothersome than hot flushes and less bothersome than tiredness or anxiety. No matter what, if somebody comes to you and they've if you experience any of these symptoms, a lot of people say, "Oh, I probably need to change the way I eat." But first, they need to go and see their GP and check, because they could be a sign of an underlying condition that we do not want to miss. And now let's focus at the gut microbiome. Again, a lot of changes happen during this time of a woman's life. And so Holly mentioned it before, but we see a change in the profile of bacteria, the gut microbiota. So postmenopause, and we shift towards a more male-like gut microbiome. We've got a reduced diversity and a decreased abundance of gut microbial... I can't say that word. So you read it, because I'm going to butcher it. The beta-glucuronidase, I think that's how you pronounce it. And I will touch on the ostrobolum on my next slide. But it also, there is a reduced gut barrier integrity. And if you were here yesterday, Yelena was telling us how important it is to protect our gut barrier integrity. So, is the gut a potential therapeutic avenue for to look after women during the menopause? Possibly, when we look at how much of what is happening during menopause and what much is linked to the gut, overlaps, okay? We've got higher cardiovascular health risk, metabolic health, bone health, cognitive health, inflammation disorder, weight management, depression and anxiety. All of these things have been linked to the gut and are happening during menopause. So there is few possible mechanisms at play here. The ostrobolome might be something to look into because of its role in hormone regulation. I'm not going to go into a long description of what the ostrobolome is, but a very simple way, it's a bunch of microbial genes that are in our gut that metabolize estrogens and recycle estrogens that were meant to be discarded. So it's almost upcycling, you know? and during menopause, the change in the gut microbiome may affect these set of bacteria and reduce this estrogen recycling. And so that might exacerbate our menopause symptoms. So could we actually create an environment where these ostrobolome, these bacteria can flourish? That might be a way of counteracting the effect of menopause. but there is a lot of if there. Another mechanism may be to look at the inflammatory pathways. So, like I said a bit earlier, there is the we've got a gut increased gut permeability. This gut barrier is being fragilized, and this may promote inflammation. So, if we could modulate the gut microbiota and its metabolites to reduce the inflammation, maybe we can improve the menopause symptom and the menopause experience. But there is a lot of if. Because the evidence is not really here at this stage. So we've got emerging evidence that there is a connection between the gut microbiota and the sex hormones and the experience of menopause. But at the moment, the mechanisms at play are not fully understood, the link is unclear, and so the evidence is very, very limited. And anyway, I just really want to talk about the gut microbiota. I'm talking about diet. But actually, it's really important to know that, that to remember that menopause is a multifaceted experience. Every woman will experience it very differently. And also, it's not only about physiological changes. There are so many things at play, and it's not only a reduction of estrogen. It's also there is also chronological aging that happened at that time of life. There is also lots of changes in our social life. Children that are going away, grandparents that are getting, parents that are getting older and need caring. It's a very stressful time of a woman's life. So very important. And I'm talking about diet. I'm passionate about diet. I am a nutritionist, but it's very important to put diet into the broader context. We really need to consider all the avenues. So pharmaceutical approach is important, psychological approach is are important, and we need to look at all the aspects of lifestyle as well when we address menopause. I think I'm still good for time. So I wanted to give you a few ideas. So now that I've put it in context, I'm going to talk about diet. and I'm going to tell you about how you can actually support women with diet. There isn't much research in this area. But at the moment, what we think is the most important thing to do for women at that time is there is no radical changes in terms of recommendation, but it matters even more at that time of life. So the Mediterranean-type diet, or maybe the Nordic diet, like Tanya mentioned yesterday, are going to be very useful. And surprise, surprise, when you think of the gut, what is a good diet is a diet that is predominantly plant-based, with whole foods, high in fruit and vegetables, whole grains, pulses, some unsaturated fat, limited amount of meat, and a very limited amount of high fat, sugar, and salt foods, and alcohol. Okay, and that seemed to be particularly good. Particularly good for cardiovascular health, gut, mood, and reduce inflammation. Okay. So this is just a suggestion of what a Mediterranean diet looks like. There is many ways. That's why I say a Mediterranean-type diet rather than the Mediterranean diet. Fiber is going to be very important as well. And again, variety is key here. But I'm just going to zoom in on a few fiber in particular that have been mentioned as being potentially useful for menopause or the symptoms that are experienced during menopause. Okay, so lignans may be an interesting fiber to use, but the research is quite limited and I would say rather inconclusive. But there is no harm in adding a bit of lignans in your diet. Where do we find lignans? Mainly in ground flax seed, but also sesame seeds, rye, and berry. Beta-glucan may be a useful fiber to look at, just because it of its cholesterol lowering properties, and we know that level of cholesterol tends to rise during menopause. We found them in oats and barley. Psyllium husk is a very decent amount of evidence to really help with gut mobility, adding bulks to our stools and consistency to our tools, so particularly with constipation. But it's a functional food, so we don't eat psyllium husk, it's mainly in food supplement. And prebiotics may be a good place to look at. I'm not going to go into all the details, but they can help with calcium absorption, blood sugar regulation, bacterial fermentation, transit time, and immune function. And within the prebiotic, one that is particularly interesting is the soya isoflavones, which are possibly something that you have in your secret product. Quite possibly, exactly. And they are interesting because they mimic, to a degree, estrogens in the body. So they may help with hot flushes, but also gut microbial activity, cardiovascular health, bone health, reduction of breast cancer risk, and possibly cognitive and mood benefits. Now, I'm not an expert in gut health, but of course we need to talk about probiotics. They may be a good place to look as well to support women's health, and also postbiotics, which are just maybe a powerful way, of activating the immune system, reducing the inflammation. But don't forget that gut health is far more than just what we eat or the food supplement that we're taking. It's influence. There was a really nice slide in Holly's presentation where we say the environment, the exercise, our sleep, our level of stress, all of these things will influence our gut health. So don't only think about food. And I will not read all the key messages because I'm probably taking too much of your time, but I just want to highlight the final point here. It's a time where women are seeking for answers. They really need help. And so we need to empower them with practical, tailored solutions, because they will all experience menopause in a very different way. And you really need to take into account their lifestyle as well as their budget. So I've seen some things sold to women during menopause where I just feel like we are really taking advantage of their vulnerability and their wallet. So I think it's important to take account their specific needs and budget. Thank you very much.
So we're going to transition into Q&A. What I'm going to do is invite all the speakers. I'll leave the mic at the front, so I'll go at the back. If you have a question, raise your hand, and we'll ensure that the right person answers the question for you.
Question for John. I work for a food brand, and we talk a bit about can we do something in gut health in the future. But so I wondered, do you have any insight or opinions to what extent people that do recognize gut health, it's kind of an occasion based around breakfast versus, you know, a gut health product that would be consumed at another time, maybe is less recognizable than breakfast yogurts and cereals and things like that.
Yeah, well, I am. Can you say what category or what brand or was it a secret? Cool. Very good. By the way, we don't think of ourselves as a breakfast brand at all. It's just, I think, probably the two leading categories that are most obvious to go into for gut health. So yogurts and cereal are consumed quite heavily at breakfast. But when we did, we don't have a lot of data. Nestle data, you could buy all the studies. But we asked basically our website users when they eat us. And about half was eaten at breakfast, but half was eaten across the rest of the day as well. So I don't know how sorghum's consumed, but definitely I think it's an all-day opportunity rather than a breakfast opportunity. And my mind's whirring now. There'd be definitely things that you could do. While I'm up here, by the way, I don't know about everybody else. We had never met each other before today, and I was just incredibly struck by... This is where science, I think, really works, where what Megan's told me is almost exactly the same as you were saying, Holly. It's almost exactly the same, even though you're focusing on one particular area. Just those themes coming through, it's so nice to hear, because it really encourages me that these messages will get through, and we don't even really think of it as a trend. It's just a shift in the way people are consuming. I think it's just going to go on and on, because the messaging is so consistent. The science is, honestly, it was extraordinary listening to what you were saying. So just thought I'd make that point.
Thank you. That was really, really interesting. It feels like gut health at the moment is targeted to the worried well. I think this is a question potentially for anyone, but how can we democratise it and how can we make it available for as many consumers as possible, particularly the ones who aren't going to do the research, aren't necessarily that interested in it? Is there a role here for basically gut health by stealth through product development and things like that?
I think that's the challenge with nutrition, is that we it's free for most of it. And I mean, obviously you need to pay for the food that you're eating, but we're all going to eat. We're all going to have a food budget. And I think what we really need to say is, we need to educate people about gut health and just say, look, there is very simple way of looking after your gut health. You don't need the general population doesn't need the super expensive food supplement or the packaged bunch of seeds with a major price tag on it. We can all buy cheap seeds and just sprinkle on our food. So I think there is a way of looking after your gut health for a small budget. But I think it's about educating people about not needing to jump on the latest fad and just thinking of all these key little things that you can do to improve your gut health without the need of expensive green powders or things like that.
We're going to bring this to a close so we can have lunch. Before we do that, should we just join hands and really appreciate all these guys? They've been amazing, haven't they? Forgot about that. Awesome. Thank you so much. See you later.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Food Matters Live podcast. We've got some exciting news to share about more live events this year. We're heading to Manchester in May, Ascot in October, and Dublin in November. And for the first time, we're hosting an event in mainland Europe. In September 2025, we'll be in Rotterdam. Join us as we inspire the future of food. Learn more and sign up at foodmatterslive.com. And we look forward to seeing you there.